deep in the Swedish forest, the only individualist radio program in Europe. This is VSI Radio International. Truth is stranger than fiction, but that's because fiction is obliged to stick to possibilities. Truth isn't. Continually having to discern between fact and fiction, this is the voice of a sovereign individual. My name is Paul Lambert. In my line of work, it's not often that I have to write in American English. There are some differences between the English spoken and written in the United States and that in the British Isles and elsewhere, beyond mere differences in spelling. Of course, the differences are not enormous, but they are substantial enough to make it necessary to use a good dictionary when writing in American English. Now, those outside my field of work, which deals with the vagaries of language itself, might not be so familiar with certain controversies concerning what may seem like very arcane matters concerning the details of correct English usage, and I'll try not to bore you with them here. I should like to mention, however, one very common source of annoyance I encounter when having to work with other translators or even customers who think they know English better than they do and who are too stubborn to admit when they've made a mistake. That source of annoyance is the Merriam-Webster, not to be confused with Merriam-Webster, dictionary. Now, to put it in broad approximate terms, with advance apologies to those who are expert in this rather narrow field, there are two approaches used in the preparation of dictionaries. One is a prescriptive approach, which means that words are entered with their meanings as they should be used in accordance with proper meaning and grammar. A prescriptive dictionary may well include slang or examples of non-standard use, but that will be clearly indicated in the text. The other approach, as used by Merriam-Webster, is a more of a statistical survey of the English language as it's commonly used, without any reference to whether or not any given usage is considered proper and standard. Thus, if you look up the word peruse in a prescriptive dictionary, you'll get the correct definition, which many native English speakers do not know, by the way. And that definition is to read carefully and meticulously. Many people think peruse means the exact opposite, namely to read through something quickly without attention to detail, and then use the word peruse in this incorrect way. Perhaps you do too. A prescriptive dictionary may or may not include this incorrect definition, but if it does, it will clearly be indicated that it's incorrect or some kind of vulgar usage of the term. Merriam-Webster, on the other hand, being no more essentially than a poll of how English speakers speak, will post both the correct and incorrect definitions with absolutely no further comment given, leaving the uninitiated reader to believe that both are correct. Thus, Merriam-Webster also lists words like access as both a noun and a verb, when in fact it's only a noun, computer talk notwithstanding. You do not access something, you gain access to something. The opposite is egress, also a noun only. You gain access and you gain egress. Conversely, many verbs have been incorrectly used as nouns. For example, even many respected newspapers will have a so-called quote of the day. Quote is only a verb. The noun is quotation. This trend of dropping the final ation has been in rapid progress, both in the British Isles and the United States. Such words, in addition to quote for quotation, include invite for invitation. More and more you might hear things like, I sent him an invite. There's even a telephone company in England, I think it's British Telecom, I'm not sure, whose TV ads announced that the company was offering each new customer a free connect, as opposed to a free connection. Merriam-Webster will list all these usages without any comment. Try it yourself. If you have a copy of the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, published since 1968 or so, look up quote, and you'll find it listed both as a noun and a verb, without any further comment as to the correctness of usage. This becomes problematic when colleagues or clients want to argue with me about a certain use of English in any text we are considering, and then cite Merriam-Webster to back up their arguments. If you ever cite Merriam-Webster to substantiate your use of English in any respect, all it proves is that you're not the only person to make that same mistake. Now, I'm accused of elitism or just asinine stubbornness when I summarily dismiss any argument based on Merriam-Webster and suggest instead the American Heritage Dictionary or even Funk and Wagnalls when writing American English. I'm asked quite bluntly, who says American Heritage is more authoritative than Merriam-Webster? Well, the answer, in effect, is Merriam-Webster. Now, I try to be kind about it, since this is not the sort of thing I expect people outside of the trade to know. But the American Heritage Dictionary came about in the mid to late 60s in response to the scholarly deficiencies present in Merriam-Webster. Had it not been for a lack of authoritativeness and completeness, there's that concept again, in Merriam-Webster, the American Heritage Dictionary would never have existed. Words have meanings and embody entire concepts. That's why it's not enough that language simply be defined as that which people use, since concepts are destroyed through improper usage. We discussed last week the idea of the anti-concept. Anti-concepts are words or terms used to obliterate valid concepts by packing them together with invalid or opposite concepts, and thus blurring clarity of thought when discussing the issues involved. Some examples of anti-concepts are the black market, which is a blanket term covering both moral and immoral economic transactions that just happen to be contrary to the law. Even taxation is an anti-concept, or has become so, as it's used to cover both payment for legitimate services rendered by the government and for pure expropriation. Anti-concepts obliterate the difference between right and wrong. Anti-concepts are the first step toward a mental phenomenon that George Orwell identified as doublethink, which is an ability to hold two conflicting concepts in one's mind simultaneously. It's what allows people to get away with using words in ways that suggest the complete opposite of their definitions. Detractors to President Obama's broad nationalization of health care in the United States will refer to it as Obamacare. However, the official name is the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. Ironically enough, Obamacare is a more honest label, as this enormous health care reform is really Barack Obama's personal pet project, while offering the patient no protection of his rights with regard to his health care, and in nearly all cases has made health insurance more unaffordable than ever. It would just be as honest for a house robber to describe his undertakings as an obligatory house cleaning and removal service. George Orwell wrote his masterpiece novel 1984 in 1948, the very same year that a new country was founded in the northern half of the Korean Peninsula, namely the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, a country notorious for its wicked suppression of democracy and oppression of its people. Even the word free runs the risk of being blurred, since it means different things in different contexts. Free, for example, in free speech, means something very different than free as in free beer. The European countries like to boast that they offer their citizens free medical care. However, in fact, it's neither free in the free speech sense nor even in the free beer sense. The system costs taxpayers an arm and a leg on one hand, and on the other hand, patients have virtually no say in their treatments, and every aspect of the patient-doctor relationship is regulated by law. both meanings of the word free are obliterated in a single fell swoop in the term free medical care. Then we have another phenomenon in which words are automatically loaded with meanings not encompassed by their definitions. Think of the word extreme, and worse, an anti-concept as extremism. By adding the suffix ism, we create a moral baggage to associate with a simple adjective, and thus ignore the salient concept being modified by that word. I have about as many conservative detractors as liberal ones, but what they will both tell me is that they do not think that I should take things to extremes. My question is, take what to extremes? Anything? Anything at all? What does extreme mean? Extreme simply means to the utmost great degree. It is not enough to condemn extremism as such without addressing what it is that's being taken to an extreme. Are the states of being extremely healthy and extremely sick equally undesirable? Would you distrust an extremely honest man as much as an extremely dishonest man? How much confidence would you have in a moderately honest man? Still, the words extreme or extremism evoke a certain negative feeling when heard or used. People are just not thinking about the words they use.
The game, don't smile and the song, don't fall down.
You might wonder why I'm being so picky about language. I understand that there is a natural shift in meanings and word usage over time, but so many changes are based on ignorance, and they serve to erase important distinctions in the minds of men, not to clarify them. Civilization degrades with the degradation of language. Civilization is not a given. Savagery and filth are the natural states of being without any thinking or action needing to be applied. Civilization is a high-maintenance machine requiring constant upkeep and improvement, both in material and intangible ways, the intangible usually being more important. Language is the faculty that distinguishes man from the lower animals. Thus, it also serves as a sort of index to the intellectual level of cultures, even between different individuals within a culture. There are cultures in the world today that are so primitive that they have no more than 50 words in their vocabularies, words for rock, fire, tree, water. All of them concretes, no abstractions. And I'm not talking about the Pacific Islands or deepest, darkest Africa. Such primitive localities exist as scattered settlements in places like the Ukraine, Russia, Romania, Poland, Turkey, Greece. Confusion and vagueness of terms are always found in socialist and otherwise collectivist social theories, and that's not accidental. It is a reversion to the mental and verbal limitations of the primitive societies that such theories advocate, and an inability to think in abstract terms. This defect is most evident in non-individualistic notions of property. Strictly speaking, physical objects in and of themselves are not property. A house, a car, a frying pan, or a book is just a house, a car, a frying pan, or a book. They become property because there is a quality of ownership associated with them. And the individual to whom the property belongs has certain rights. Property is ownership. Things which nobody owns are not property. They're just things. A chunk of rock in the asteroid belt in space is not property. Now, perhaps the most ridiculous of the famous statements concerning property was once uttered by 19th century French parliamentarian Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, often said to have been the first anarchist, when he claimed that all property is theft. Now, of course, I understand that it was a bit of a verbal shorthand on his part. What he was suggesting was that for any one man to claim any material value for himself unjustly deprives everyone else of that material value to which they are all equally entitled, in his view. That position is wrong, but it's made nonsensical by the short sentence, "All property is theft." That sentence is remarkable in itself, if for no other reason but the many logical errors compounded into so few words. It confuses objects, acts, attributes, moral values, and relations as if they were all interchangeable. The sentence is contradictory on the surface. Theft presupposes ownership. An object must be property before it can possibly be stolen. Those objects that are not owned by anyone are simply that, not owned, unowned. No material object has any value apart from their utility to the human being in possession of it. Natural resources that we consider valuable in our society today, be it oil, gold, timber, or even just land, without the application of human thought and energy, simply remains useless raw materials and remain unowned. Even highly refined products only have value relative to the people who have them. We think of computers and television sets as valuable property, but of what value would they have to a caveman, unable even to make sense of them, let alone use them? Material objects become property when human effort is applied to them. Without human effort, the object remains worthless, unused, and more importantly, unowned. Therefore, all property is private property, quite simply because everything of material value was created by someone and belongs to somebody. This is the reason why private property belongs to man as a creative being by right. and why the popular notion of so-called public property is an absurdity. Surely more than one person can have a share in ownership in one asset, but then each person has an allotted share to which he has a right of ownership according to terms agreed between him and the other owners. It's still private property. A number of persons may reside in the same house, for instance, but that does not mean that the general public can come in and out, sit in the chairs, sleep in the beds, and cook in the kitchen. Think too of the many assets owned by various government agencies for which it's claimed that they are owned by the people, but to which you as a member of the public do not have access. You cannot take it upon yourself to go drive around in police cars or fly fighter jets or even set up shop in a government office building, even though this is said to be public property. Conversely, there are many privately owned locations such as supermarkets, restaurants, bowling alleys, cinemas, and shopping malls, to which the general public is invited to come in at its leisure, but within the bounds set by the property owner and for purposes predetermined by him. In theory, public property belongs to everybody equally, indivisibly, and simultaneously, which is an absurd assertion. Isabel Patterson offers an example of how a consistent application of such a notion would manifest itself. Any individual presenting himself to make use of any given piece of public property might be asked, "Are you everybody?" To which the answer is obviously no, and thus he has no claim. However, I often like to ask a more concrete question. If you live in one state or a country in which you have citizenship or have paid tax to maintain such public property, do you get to sell your share in all the public property when you move? Can I sell the section of street and the lamppost outside my old house in Reykjavik or in Gothenburg or in any city I've lived, and now that I've moved away and no longer have the same benefit of the same public property that the remaining public uses? In terms of usage, the closest thing we have to public property are the roads and bridges, but still no one passenger has an indefinite right to occupy one spot on the road. Moreover, since the rights to property are the rights to use and disposal, as the owner chooses, logically any member of the public could choose to pitch a tent on the motorway or build an ice cream stand on the median. Or would he? Another member of the public, simultaneously having the right to use and disposal, would be entitled to bulldoze such structures and put up a skating rink in the middle of the highway instead. Or would this violate the property rights of the first members of the public to pitch the tent? If so, and the first people are indeed entitled to pitch their tents and build their ice cream stands, wouldn't this violate the property rights of those who want to bulldoze them, who, according to the theory of public property, are equally, indivisibly, and simultaneously entitled to use the same property at their leisure? In mathematics, this logical process is used in disproving a postulate. You start off with a premise, and at first assume it to be true, and then demonstrate everything that such a premise would entail until you reach an irreconcilable contradiction, which then means that the postulate cannot be true. By its very premise, public property as a concept is absurd. It is simply a matter of fact that of physical reality that two objects cannot occupy the same space at the same time. You, as a private individual, have no right of ownership in anything popularly referred to as public property. For instance, the so-called public utilities are not available to the public as owners. Any member of the public wishing to obtain electricity from the municipal supplier must pay for it out of his own private resources, and rightly so. Neither the utility nor the electricity it generates belong to him. He's not the owner. An owner does not need to buy the product of his own property. At the other end of the equation, a citizen who does not use any electricity at all, perhaps he even lives by candlelight and paraffin-powered appliances, he is nevertheless charged indirectly for the upkeep of such utilities through his taxes, while he can exercise no rights of ownership over the plant whatsoever. The only thing that truly seems to be public about public property is the liability and that liability can be unlimited. Members of the public have nothing to do with the asset side of the equation. Go try and get a bank loan and put up your supposed share of the local public utility as collateral and see what happens. Ask yourself as well, when is the last time you got dividends from the local municipal utility? When did you last get an invitation to a general shareholders meeting? It's impossible to imagine any practical method by which the use of any kind of property or asset can be made available to the public as such. Nobody can just help himself to electricity or potatoes or water or cable TV or medical care in his capacity as a member of the public simply according to his needs. The concept has no application in a productive society. The concept is limited to a context of wild nature where primitive men live on whatever they can hunt or gather. However, as Isabel Patterson points out, even in such cases, there is a sense of property rights as the individual hunter hands out portions of his kill as he sees fit, once he has kept the portion he prefers for himself. The reason why socialists cannot seem to understand these insurmountable obstacles in the way of their belief in public property is because the notion of the collective, as such, has no dimensions, no measures, and no limitations. Conversely, a society founded on private property is organized according to the three spatial dimensions that man experiences. All men and all material objects occupy a given location and take up space in any given moment of time. Notice that time, as well, is a vague concept in collectivist thinking. European communists always claimed that their states located in the East were in a state of socialism and in the process of transition into communism. Communism was always in the future, never the present. Forgetting that all material values are created by someone and belonging to somebody, collectivist theories all began with the assumption that productive capital in the system overall is to be taken over from private property and personal enterprise. A hypothetical socialist society must therefore be non-productive, as production creates its own means of production. Still, they cannot imagine any practical method to deliver on what they promise. All they offer are ideas on paper on how to distribute the values that would once have been created by private enterprise and ignore the societal conditions that made such production possible in the first place. They deny the right of an owner and producer to his property and product, and thus to his own labor, and thus to his own person. Ultimately, all collectivist societies demand forced labor and destroy any genuine exchanges. All that's left is expropriation and the dole. Collectivists will often use the word right to describe the claim that the general public has to certain material values, but that word never corresponds to reality. Of course, the most radical among them, the Marxists, based their social theories on dialectical materialism, a deterministic view that admits no right or wrong. Speech itself, the very tool for communication and clarity, is twisted, causing confusion and obliterating legitimate concepts. Production requires exact communication as the means for the necessary organization. The collectivists destroy those very means and revert man back to savagery, even below savagery. The level of draft animals and animals need no language.
Early morning yesterday, I was up before the dawn, and I really have enjoyed my stay, but I must be moving on. Like a king without a castle, like a queen without a throne, I'm an early morning lover. What you say is the undisputed truth, but I have to have things my own way to keep me in my youth. Like a ship. just can't tell. Some they will and some they won't. Some it's just as well. You can laugh at my behavior, and that'll never bother me. Say the devil is my savior, but I don't pay no heed. And I will go out shining, you shine a light brand new. I'll never look behind me, my troubles will be few.
Listening to VSI Radio International. To contact the program, please send an email to feedback@vsiradio.org. That's feedback@victorsierraindiaradio.org. VSI Radio International is produced in Sweden, exclusively for broadcast on WBCQ, transmitting from Monticello, Maine, USA, on 7,490 kHz. My name is Paul Lambert.
Back then, long time ago, when grass was green, woke up in a daze, arrived like strangers in the night. Fab. Long time ago, when we was fab. Back when income tax was all we had.
We have seen that in a collective society, in which all property is public, the members of the public indeed have no right to any of the property that supposedly is owned by all of them in common. Collectivists of all stripes will, for instance, quite openly admit that they are willing to violate property rights in order to safeguard civil rights. This, too, is logically absurd, as in a society without property rights, no civil rights can exist. Exactly, because there's no place in which they can be exercised and no materials on which they can take effect. How can freedom of speech be exercised if there's no spot on which any individual may make a speech, nor any place his audience has a right to sit and listen? How can there be a free press if materials used to make newspapers are not privately owned? With public ownership, that is, under state ownership, nothing can be done except by command or by permission. A man who lives by command and permission is not a free man. He is a slave. Individual private property, as a concept, allows every man a natural right to his own property. There are many ways in which he can obtain it. He might inherit it, or else he might earn enough money to purchase it. Such is reasonably possible for any able-bodied, competent man within his natural lifetime. Once he has it, it is his, and it is an absolute right. Yes, absolute. There's the extremism again. Of course, we should examine the case against private property in this respect, all of its conceivable disadvantages, and take it at its worst. Many of us have not inherited any property. Nor have we managed to accumulate enough from our earnings before facing hard times. Some have had the chance but neglected it, but many others may never have had such a chance. Some people are too young to have earned very much. Others have been very productive but have fallen sick or suffered some kind of major loss. While new opportunities will most likely arise again in the future, that fact itself does not make the immediate situation any better. Such persons will face some degree of hardship, which when contrasted to those around him that seem to be doing much better, will seem worse than it really is. However, are the unemployed in this condition because they have no access to the land, for instance? Do they simply not have the means available to those somewhat more fortunate in this regard. For the historical perspective, I once more refer to Isabel Patterson when she wrote the following. In Europe, during modern times, practically all the usable land was owned. There was no wild land to which an unemployed man could have access, and the owners of the land were unlikely to permit the unemployed to use it rent-free. But in the United States, there was never a day in hard times when the unemployed could not have access to wild land, or even to owned land which the owner would have let them use for production. Yet in hard times, men did not have to go into the wilderness. The statement that the land frontier took up the slack of unemployment during industrial depressions is a whole cloth falsehood. On the contrary, the frontier was settled from the capitalist production overflow of good times. During hard times, men withdrew from the frontier, even abandoning homesteads, and turned back toward the areas of more advanced development, the towns and the industrial developments. So it is said that the unemployed are denied access to the means of production, which includes the land. However, the means of production of an industrial economy are not to be found ready-made in nature. The man who wants employment then requires something more than his original natural right. He requires the use of the tools, accumulated capital, and organization of a highly productive economy to apply to the resources of nature. But this definition still does not cover the whole effect. The owners of industrial property occasionally run at losses to keep up their plant and business connections for the future. In the United States, during times of stress, many employers would certainly be glad if they could run in full employment for the time being at the bare cost of materials, maintenance, and wages of labor and management. Dividends can wait and are often deferred, but if an idle plant, including even a stock of raw materials, were handed over to unemployed workers, thus giving them free access to the means of production, the workers would be unable to get continued production out of it to pay for their labor, because that depends on a continued exchange at a profit. They could only use up the stock and then stop working. Thus, the unemployed man in a private property economy has not lost his natural rights and is suffering no greater hazard or privation than he would in a state of nature.
I would have given you all of my heart, but that someone is torn it apart. And she's taken almost all that I've got, but if you want, I'll try to love again. Baby, I'll try to love again, but I know
the first cut is the team.
Finally, there's one more aspect concerning the false notion of public property, which will be of particular interest to radio enthusiasts, and that concerns the property status of the airwaves. In principle, there's no difference between the ownership of land and the ownership of airwaves. Two people cannot occupy the same piece of real estate without interfering with one another, and the only issue is in the task of defining the application of property rights. In terms of property rights, there's no difference between a radio broadcast and, say, a piano concert held within a concert hall. Simply, the former requires more sophisticated electronic equipment. It'd be unusual to claim that a concert pianist owns his fingers and his piano and perhaps even owns the venue in which he plays. But he does not own the air within that concert hall, and may he not play his concert without first getting a license to make use of that air through which his sound is transmitted. Yet this is the very absurdity being applied to the electromagnetic spectrum when it comes to radio broadcasting. The principal argument behind the current state of affairs regarding the legal status of the radio waves is based on the notion of the radio waves being public property. The oft-repeated rationale is that radio facilities are limited and the radio spectrum is not large enough to accommodate everyone who might want to make use of it. There is a fixed natural limitation on the number of channels that can be used without interfering with one another. Now, while these arguments are very often put forth when the issue arises, their fallacy should be obvious. Indeed, the number of broadcast facilities and frequencies is limited. So is the number of concert halls. So is the amount of oil, wheat, or any other commodity. So is the acreage of land on the face of the globe. Nothing exists in unlimited quantities. One of the proper functions of government is to protect individual property rights, and pursuant to that, it may formulate laws that define how such protections are to be applied. That is, only to define, not to create, invent, donate, or expropriate. The issue of property rights and radio frequencies could very well have been dealt with in the United States the same way that rights concerning such things as inventions and scientific discoveries, oil rights, vertical space rights, and others have been addressed, which traditionally has served to protect the rights of the individuals involved, not to abrogate them. The entire electromagnetic spectrum could have been subject to a measure similar to the Homestead Act. Under the Homestead Act, a homesteader could stake out a plot of previously unused and unowned land, and after a certain period of the land being developed and improved, the homesteader's right to that newly created property would be recognized by the government. It's important to note that under the Homestead Act, the property in question was not considered to be owned by the government. Rather, the government was simply the custodian of the ownerless resource, and it outlined objective rules by which a homesteader could potentially make the land into his own rightful property. A very similar setup could and still should apply to broadcast frequencies. Now, there's nothing wrong with the government defining certain parts of the spectrum for different kinds of use, and nothing wrong with defining the property boundaries, as it were, between adjacent parcels on the spectrum. In this respect, on the medium wave broadcast band, channels are spaced 10 kHz apart in North America, 9 kHz apart elsewhere. However, once a serious operator took to a hitherto unused frequency and maintained use for a certain period of time, it would become his property. Each channel in time would become the property of radio pioneers on a first-come, first-served basis. Any latecomers wishing to enter into the broadcasting business would have to offer to buy a frequency from another operator that already owns one. Now, many may argue that the limited number of stations would serve to entrench the existing pioneers and lock out any newcomers. But in fact, the opposite is true. The limited number of stations would not lock them in, but rather threaten their hold if they do not make the best economic use of their stations, which is what happens with every other kind of valuable property. Someone not making such use and turning a profit would not long afford to hold on to such an asset. The argument from scarcity is made about many commodities, and just like with all other commodities, in order to make it widely available, you make it private property and throw it onto the free market. Collectivists often point to the early days of radio as an example of the failure of the free enterprise. Namely, at a time when broadcasters had no legal protection for their frequencies and could be subject to harmful interference. However, this was not a result of private property rights, but of their absence. Such chaos on the airwaves was not a case of free enterprise, but of anarchy, of a failure on the part of the government to serve one of its few legitimate functions, namely to enforce private property rights. What the world of broadcasting needs and would still need today is not government control, but a legally enforceable framework of legality. What would this mean in practice? Well, private ownership of the airwaves would mean that an owner would not continually have to renew a license and be subject to a review by the FCC. Who could possibly take away a station's license if the content of broadcasts were controversial or otherwise displeasing to the powers that be? It would be the end of all censorship on the airwaves, as property rights would confer an absolute right to use and disposal of such property, no matter what the powers that be think of it. Remember, private property is ultimately the source of all legitimate authority, and what allows people to disagree with one another. Without so-called public ownership of the airwaves, there would be no chilling effect to keep broadcasters from producing programs as they see fit.
Have you seen the well-to-do up and down Park Avenue on that famous thoroughfare with their noses in the air? High hats and arrow collars, white spats and lots of dollars, spending every dime for a wonderful time. Now if you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits, putting on the Ritz. Different types who wear a day coat, pants with stripes and cutaway coat, perfect fits, putting on the Ritz. Dressed up like a $1 million trooper, trying hard to look like Gary Cooper. Super duper, come let's mix, where Rockefellers walk with sticks or umbrellas in their mitts, putting on the Ritz. His hat just like an English chappie to a lady with a wealthy pappy. Very snappy, you'll declare, it's simply topping to be there and hear them swapping smart tidbits, putting on the Ritz.
Thank you for joining me this evening on VSI Radio International. Don't forget to tune in next week at the same time for more commentary from an individualistic perspective. Until we meet again, this is Paul Lambert wishing you all the best.
If you've enjoyed this presentation, visit www.justrightmedia.org for more programming that's not right-wing, it's just right.